Welcome to episode 54 of Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. Bah, 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 bah. Today we are very excited to have a guest, Tasha Darius, and I want to say a little bit about how we met her. When Booty was visiting before we went to Rhinebeck, we became very concerned that we might not have enough exposure to yarns. So we cast about and thought we should really go to a local yarn store near me in Sturbridge, Massachusetts. And so we came up on Woolworks Limited in Putnam, Connecticut, and we walked in to this magical place. Tasha's going to talk a little bit more about that, but we walked into this magical place where there were all these women sitting around on a Tuesday afternoon, knitting and talking and laughing and singing the theme song to the Brady Bunch. It was absolutely fabulous. We could tell we had just walked into this amazing community of knitters, and we got to talking and learned that Tasha was the manager, and she's also a spinner and spinning teacher. So we just thought, oh, we have to have her on Booty and Bossy because we know we're going to learn a lot of stuff. So we always like to start by asking you, how did you start in the fiber arts? Who taught you? Who was your inspiration? What was your first project? All that stuff.
So my family is Haitian. So I was born in the U.S. My parents were born in Haiti. And so we don't knit. Knitting, crochet, working with wool, that just wasn't a part of what I grew up with because people lived in very hot climates. So the things that were passed on to me were stories and recipes and music and wood carving and things of that nature. Nothing that you would cuddle up to. But I was raised here, and a lot of my friends came from families where the things that were passed on to them were things like knitted afghan or booty, things of that nature. Things that you could wrap yourself up with. And I remember when I was probably 10 or 11, it's the first time I started thinking about, oh, I think I want to do something like that. But I didn't have anything to teach me, but it was on my brain, was when I visit some of my friends, and I would sit on their couch, and everything at the house had been made by grandmother or great grandmother, and things were just passed on through the family. And I've always been very nostalgic. So when I turned 19 or 20, I decided I can teach myself how to do this. My 20s, we were still not quite the net to get your information because it just wasn't quite there yet. So I went to the library that I grew up in. And I asked the librarian to ask a minute. And she said, I think so. So she brought me up to this little section, and there were probably 12 books on the shelf on various things. And they had a 6-book limit, but because no one ever took any of these books out, and she knew me, she let me check out all 12 books in one fell swoop. And so I went to Ridge's, which at the time was the family run. Basically, you could find fabric, anything that was textural, they fold it there. That's what that family did. And then Walmart came in shortly after. They ended up having to close down. But I went to Ridge's and I got a skein of some really cheap yarn. I got a pair of the biggest needles. I think they were like a size 13, but I was on a worsted weight yarn. So whatever I was going to make was going to be a disaster because I didn't understand anything. But that's what I walked out with, a cheap ball yarn and a size 13 pair of metal needles. And I just went for the weekend and just started reading through the books and trying to figure things out. And once it started to look like something, a terrible something, but it was still a piece of material, I fell in love with it. I like to see how things are constructed. I've always been interested in how things work or why things happen. So I will dive any rabbit hole. The minute you get me interested in something and it starts out, well, how did that work? I need to know all of the things. And so once that happened, I needed to know all of the things. So the first thing I made was, at this point now, I would consider it to be like a sampler scarf because I wanted to see, well, what happens if I do this? And what happens if I do that? And that's how I started to understand the structuring of knitting. And I carried it around with me everywhere I went. I had a little bag with this really ugly yarn, and I would pull it out at any time, and I would just work on it, and it just became something, which I thought was just incredible. Then once I got to the point where I felt I had learned all that I could on my own, I started to ask around to see if anybody knew of a place that could teach me more things. And there was this little yarn shop in a woman's basement that she had opened. And they told me, go see her and she'll help you. So I did. I don't think she realized how beginner I was. I walked in, told her, I want to learn how to knit. I want to learn how to work with really nice yarn. And she carried really beautiful yarn. And I can't remember the name of the bamboo yarn, but this company had just come out of the beautiful bamboo yarn. And so she said, oh, yes. She said, this would be great. They had a sample of the bamboo workshop, and it was this shawl. So I said, well, that's pretty. So I buy all of the bamboo yarn to make this beautiful shawl. That was all part of it. It was late, and it was the Mariposa with the shawl. I went home, and I figured it out. But I knew as I was figuring it out, this was not the topic. This was too much. So I put it aside, and I went back to her 2 days later. And when I walked in, she said, you know, I'm so happy to get back because Ashley left. And then our conversation sunk in. I realized, wait a minute, that poor girl is not going to be able to get through that project if she doesn't know the basics. So then she started me on a basic sweater. It was a pure and simple top-down sweater using a worsted weight yarn on 7 and 8 inch. And that was my first successful project.
Did you ever go back and do the shawl?
Funny story, the Mariposa is in my queue because I am determined that that shawl needs to happen. So I will be making that shawl. And it's so funny because I didn't know if it was still available.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on Ravelry to look for it and I found it. But I looked at the chart and I was like, okay, but back then I was like, what is happening? But I will make that shawl.
People don't understand, especially when they go to buy something and they look at the price of a hand-knit item and they say, oh, why is it so expensive? They don't understand that you're not only paying for the time that it took to make that thing, but all of the hours that went before that to get to that level to be able to make that thing.
Absolutely.
Where was this woman's basement? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Scotland, Connecticut. And this little shop, it was called Yarns with a Twist. The owner's name was Sandy, well, still is, Sandy Macharzik, and she was in Chaplin, Connecticut. So at that time, she was only about 10 minutes from my house. But our house was set off the road. You would know that there was a little yarn shop in there. You'd have to drive down a little across her lawn to go down the hill to get to the back door to get to her basement. And you walked in. And it was not a large basement. You'd open the door and it would just about fit the chair at the table, but she had a table set up. And it was like a little tight little wonderland. You would just walk around these little nooks and crannies, and you turn a little corner and boom, there would be another shelf of this beautiful yarn. It was magical. And I pretty much lived there. I couldn't get enough of it. I was completely addicted to it. And I just met my people. I got to talk to really amazing people every single day.
Well, now, what was the reaction of your family? Because I appreciate what you were saying about how knitting and crocheting, that wasn't part of the Haitian culture that you grew up in, which makes complete sense. Why would they be knitting wool? But when you first started doing this, what was their response?
They weren't surprised. They looked at me, they're like, what are you? I think because I've always been a really, really old soul. So you're knitting? Wouldn't we do it? But they know me well enough to know that if something sparks my interest, I'm going to go for it wholeheartedly. But they're also the same way, but in different ways, in different things. So we're all musicians. So that was one big way for us to connect. And we were always diving and digging to learn more things. We We've worked, we've collaborated on a lot of things together. We're always exploring different things musically together. They were used to me coming up with something new to kind of learn about. And now they're a little spoiled because they want something and I can make it for them. So.
Yeah. So the genetic material of curiosity was there. It's just it manifested in different ways. I mean, and I especially appreciate that you had to go to the library because I think it's so much easier now with YouTube and with videos. So trying to go to the library, I mean, I've sat down with knitting books and thought, so I'm in awe of you learning all this stuff the old way because you're an old soul. So you went to the library, old soul, learning it and doing old things. But tell us about, I mean, we have talked with the sheep shearer, Christina Kading, and Debbie Frabel of Serial Knitters. She was a dyer. So we were especially excited when you said that you taught spinning because we haven't really talked with anyone about spinning. So take us through. So you started with knitting.
So what happened was if I take away the yarns with a twist, the owner, she became interested in spinning. And what was funny for her, I think it was also a nostalgic thing because I don't know if she came from a Polish background or if her husband came from a Polish background. But she saw a Fronsky spinning wheel, which is a Polish wheel, and she fell in love. She reached out to a local weaver and spinner to ask her if she could teach her how to spin. And I happened to be there on the day that this woman came in with the spinning wheel. I had seen spinning wheels before because I had gone to Discovery Village, but I honestly had no idea what a spinning wheel did. I didn't know anything about roving. I didn't know anything about any of it. I just knew I could walk into a store and there was yarn and I could buy it. I didn't know where they came. And she came out with this tuft of roving and she sat down with Bambi and she started spinning it on the wheel. And then I was floored, fascinated, floored, all the things. And so I asked if I could try it. And I was able to go to this woman's studio and she showed me all of her wheels and all of the stuff that she had made and the yarn that she had made. And again, that was like, here's another rabbit hole. And so I was like, I am invested and I'm going to do this. So that's really how that started. And I ended up stumbling upon it was an older Ashford traditional, I think, which was from what, late 70s or early 80s that somebody was getting rid of. So I purchased it and just started to play with it. And once I started to understand all of the things, I ended up falling in love with that part of it and would just collect them. I've got a collection of wheels now. It's hard to see where I would be if I didn't have these things. If I wasn't knitting or crocheting or spinning or weaving or designing patterns or any of that, like I know it could happen, but I really can't see where I would be if I didn't have
So how many spinning wheels do you have? How many?
28.
28. And do you have, I mean, is this like asking who's your favorite child? Do you have a favorite amongst the 28 or?
So I definitely do have favorites for sure, but they're favorites for different reasons. So I would say my Ashford Kiwi 2 is probably my favorite wheel to use. It's the most comfortable because it's a double treadle. The height of it works well for me regardless of where I'm sitting. I find it's a gentle spinning wheel, so it's not aggressive in how it takes fiber from you. I feel like it's very approachable. It's easy to learn on. So when I teach people how to spin, I always start people off on a drop spindle because I feel that for you to become a successful spinner without the aggravation that comes along with not getting the hang of it quickly, I think it's important for you to understand exactly what the spinning wheel is doing. And so the drop spindle for me is a very basic but very easy way to understand what the spinning wheel is actually doing. Because otherwise, when people watch somebody spin on a spinning wheel, they're seeing people, they can't really, but they're not really understanding what each job, like what every movement is doing. So when I teach, we'll do two classes, and I always start you off on adoption so that we can talk about drafting, we can talk about the actual spinning part. Just all of those things on a very basic path. Then I send you home for a week or two, however long it is until you come back to see me again. And I send you home with the drop bill. I send you home with the hospital road thing. And you go and you do your thing. And then call me when you want to move on to the next step. So then you come back and then I put you on a spinning wheel. And the spinning wheel that I usually put people on will be my K2 because I find it to be the easiest to learn on. Like I said, it's not an aggressive wheel. It's just sturdy. Like I've never worried that I'm gonna break it. It's just a very sturdy, simplistic wheel. And so I'll teach them how to spin on the wheel and it clicks quicker for them because I will literally take the drop spindle and I say, this is this part of the spinning wheel. The spinning was that you do it when you flick it to twist it, that's what your feet are doing. And so I can they now understand it. They understand what their hands are doing. They understand what the fiber is doing. And then they just get it. And then after that, I send them home with my wheel for a week.
You had a recommendation for the drop spindle that to start with, Katrinkles.
Yeah, can I tell you, I love Katrinkles. Holy moly.
Yeah.
I'd be, holy moly, I would be poor if I lived close to the Katrinkles. But anyway, I was not planning on purchasing any drop spindle. I mean, no, that's a lie. I was planning on purchasing a drop spindle. I can't even lie. That's a terrible thing. I can't lie to anybody. But so I was planning on purchasing a drop spindle. But I was planning on purchasing one that was probably hand-carved or carved. Something, I was planning on quite a bit of money on something that was beautiful and all the things. So I had got it to the Patrickle booth because I was looking for her little round cage. She had a little round circular cage that I thought was pretty nice. So that's why I went into that booth I was looking for. And her mom was there and her mom was sitting on the Turkish spindle. And I said, oh, that's really cute. Because I love often. And then I looked up to the table and I saw the package that it was in. What you essentially get is all the different sizes. So they come apart. And so she, I believe it goes from 3 ounces up to 10 in sizes. And you can get her change the spoke. So you can decide the weight of your spindle. You can change the weight of the spindle depending on the type of yarn that you want to spin.
So take us through that. If you wanted to spin a worsted, would the spindles be heavier?
Again, I would use a heavier spindle to be able to take on that heavy yarn because every time I twist it, if I'm using it as a true draft spindle, that weight is got to be able to sustain the fiber that I'm making. If I
Okay.
want to make it thin on a heavy one, it would be too tight. It would break that
Right.
fiber to be able. So you have these little tiny ones. So this one is a 3 ounce one that I'm working on right now during this interview. But she has all of these legs that come apart and they go all the way up to 10 ounces. So let's say that I wanted to spin something and it kind of fell in between. It was too light for one spindle, but it was a little still too heavy for another spindle. I can literally mix and match my spokes to create the spindle weight that I want for the yarn that I want to create. So basically, I was sold. I looked at this thing and I said, listen to me, my friend. This was like eight different Turkish spindles in a package all together for $70. And I said, sign me up. Sign me up. Sign me up. And I love it.
I love how you described the spinning wheels because I feel like there's a way that you're also describing like a partner. Like you want sturdy, you want not aggressive, approachable, and now we've added variable. If you're feeling a lightweight yarn, you want to be able to do that. But then if you're feeling like you wanted a bulky, you'd be able to do that. And I think that's just what we all really want. We want sturdy, approachable, and flexible.
Absolutely. I want to know what you're doing with it. So like just all overall, that would be like my favorite wheel. But if I wanted to do something where I needed something that helped me spin faster, I need something more aggressive. So I have a Roulette S10 and I call that one my workhorse. I mean, it just wants to go. It just pulls. It's the intake, the uptake, the go, go, go. So I have to be in that aggressive mode, working with a fiber that's not too slippery. So I would never work on, this is me personally, there are spinners out there who can do all of the things. I could do the things, but I like to pick what I'm doing the things on. So I would never take this merino silk blend and put it on my Roulette, because I would not, like, I've had enough control over the machine, over the wheel, to create the type of yarn that I want. But if I know that I have a fiber, let's say like a Gotland, which for me is a little stickier, I could do something like that because I would work it a little thicker than we do, and I would be able to get the type of yarn that I wanted on that wheel. That wheel won't take it from me. It's fast, it's ready. It comes with me too much. It's fast. It's like it just wants to do the work and it wants to do the work quickly. So I use that wheel. That's my favorite turnip wheel. And then I have my two prompts, which I got especially because it was the first wheel that I was kind of introduced to. That was the wheel that I fell in love with because I saw it for the first time with Sandy. And so I purchased the prompt Mazurka, which they don't make anymore. But I purchased it because it was this really teeny tiny castle wheel. So she's tall, like in stature, but really she's just like a little shorty, short thing. The wheel has turned beautiful spindle, two rows of spindles, one bigger spindle going around, and on the inside there's another round of tiny spindles kind of offset in between this row. And I had done a little research on the wheel. Apparently there was a Polish dance that was the mazurka, and it was a traditional dance, and the men would form a circle, and then the women would form a circle on the inside, and they would dance together. And so the spokes of this wheel were supposed to represent that thing. I'm nostalgic, so for me, that was all I needed. I was like, well, I need this wheel. So I purchased that wheel.
Oh, that's so.
I made it into another prompt, which is the minstrel. And it's just a big one, the big one. And I had to get it because when it stood next to the mazurka, it looked like a big brother with a little sister. And so I get to have that too. So now I have Stanislav, who's the big one, and Anastasia, who's the little.
I love that you've named them. Your spinning wheels are your children. And I love how you're also justifying having 28 of them
Yeah.
because each
Yeah.
one does a slightly different task depending
Yeah.
on the material and depending on your mood.
Yeah. I love that. But there are times I'll pull one out because I feel like they're neglected and I don't want them. That if possible, substitute. So every once in a while, I will pull them out. I have one that I call my Chatty Cathy because no matter what you do, she is squeaky, squeak, squeak, squeak. And I just feel that she has a lot to say, and I'm not going to silence her. Her voice needs to be heard every once in a while. And so I will pull her out every once in a while, like, well, talk to me. And she is loud, squeaky and clunky, and I love her.
Did you have a project that you would recommend for people to use hand spun yarn? I mean, whether they made it their own or bought some of yours.
So I would like to tell people with their first balls, but the first skein of yarn or ball of yarn that you successfully create, I promise you're going to think it's the ugliest thing that has ever come to fruition. But I always encourage people to save it. Take a picture of it and treat it the way you would any other yarn. So fly it, soak it, hang it, do all of the things that you would do. And so it were the most beautiful skein of yarn. And just think about how much yarn you have. Sometimes you only have enough to make like a little square. Sometimes you are diligent enough or stubborn enough, like myself, where you're like, no, I'm just going to keep going and going and going until I feel like I get it. And end up with a fair quantity of it. And then I tell them, let's find something with this yardage to see what's made. There's the sense of pride and joy that comes along with it because We have created something from scratch. We have created everything about this piece. You've created the yarn. You've decided what it's going to look like. You've picked the project. It's just a lot of love. And again, I don't have children, but I didn't know when my sisters had their kids. And I was able to look at my sisters' faces when they looked at their babies for the first time. And that realization on their faces when they were just like, I made this. I made this whole human being. And there's a perfection of, there is just this feeling of accomplishment and pride and all those things. So on a much less level, I'm not saying that you're going to feel like you birthed a whole child, but there is this sense of, oh my goodness, I made this. I made this from scratch with my own, which I think is very powerful.
Is there anything that people who want to buy hand spun yarn should look for or avoid? I mean, I think most knitters understand that particularly hand spun yarn by a local spinner is special. You know, it's not something that's mass produced, but is there anything that people should look for or avoid?
Well, you want to make sure it's neat. I think that's the first thing. Like, just run your hand over it, make sure it's neat. Kind of look through it to make sure you're not seeing things like little moths or little eggs or little things like that. But for the most part, I don't run into that quite often. I think the most important thing about a hand-spun yarn as someone who's buying it is to know what the intention of it is. If you're getting it for somebody or if you're getting it for yourself, just to know what it is that you like. So the first thing I do is I put the yarn to my face, and that helps me decide what it is that I want it for. So if I know I want to do something with it that I'm going to wear on my body, if it's going to touch my neck or it's going to touch my ears or something, I put it right up to my face and see what it feels like. Other than that, real intention is, as long as the yarn is clean, I think every skein of yarn is really special. It really is. As long as you know what you want to do with it, or you know that just looking at it just brings you joy, buy it. If you see it and you're like, I love that colorway, I have no idea what I would do with it, but there was like a little flutter in your heart when you looked at it, buy it. Because it's either going to make you happy sitting on your shelf and you can look at it and pet it every other day, and then, or someday it's going to say to you, I want to be something finally, and then you know what to do with it. But other than that, I think the imperfection of a hand-spun yarn is what makes hand-spun yarn so beautiful. So don't buy a hand-spun yarn if you're looking for something that is 100% uniform, because you're going to disappoint. It's supposed to have all of these little tiny flecks of what people would consider to be imperfections. And those are not imperfections. Hand-spun yarn, those are the characters of. And it's really hard to tell if they have like a lot of break to it, because it's usually tanked up. So there will be so much. You could take it if you want to take a look at it and see if it looks like it's applied well together. You could do that if that matters to you. But for me, that doesn't really matter, because if it breaks at some point, I'll just add it on again or felt it together and just go on my merry way. I'm an easy person to sell yarn to, just because I don't really think there are too many problems that I can't overcome. It's just all about how it feels for you. There are yarns that are spun fairly tightly, they're applied pretty aggressively, so it can feel a little ropey. So I would say definitely work your patience so that you can get the hand that you want, because the yarn might feel soft, and then when you work with it, because of how it was applied, it works up a little tighter than you thought it would. And
Oh,
so it
interesting.
just does its own thing. So I would definitely say work up a few swatches and feel the hand of that material before you decide what you're going to, like, you're not going to make a whole sweater and then paint it because you don't like how it feels. Definitely work on it. I find that for a lot of my own hand-spun yarn, I will usually work them on a needle size that's probably 1 to 2 sizes bigger than I normally would, because I tend to ply a little tight. I like the way it looks when I ply a little tighter. When I ply loosely, to me, it feels like it's not complete. That could be like own person, I don't know, control issues. I don't know what's happening there. So I know that when I'm making a garment or I'm making a shawl or something I know is going to fit by somebody's face, I will work them on a needle size up, 2 needle sizes up, so that I get the lock and the drape that I want. But other than that, buy what you love, know that you're supporting somebody who's doing what they love, and just know that it will speak to you in some way. And then if it doesn't speak to you, but it speaks to somebody else, that's the universe telling you to give it to them.
Oh, I love that. What do you think is the, just in terms of teaching spinning? Because I think plenty of people do things and they don't decide to teach it. How did you make that transition to teaching spinning? And what do you think is the toughest thing? I mean, you already talked about starting on the spindle. What is the toughest thing? Or maybe even tell us your favorite teaching story, because we're all teachers here, so we all have teaching stories.
We all have teaching stories. Like I was saying to you before we had started about finding their language. I think as people who teach, it's really important for us to spend a lot of time listening and observing because everyone has their own way of learning them. And it's our job to figure out what their language is. So I do spend a lot of time. I'll start it. There's always a textbook way of saying it. And this is what happens. And I'm always watching your face because your eyes will tell me if it registers with you. If it doesn't register you, I'll see it. I see it right behind the eyes. There's that flicker. There's just something that happens. And I know, okay, that's not the way they're going to learn. And so then I have to find another way of explaining. So I have a bunch of different scenarios that I'll use, for instance, like with drafting. It's always the toughest part when people start to spin it, the coordination of the feet and the hands and the wheel pulling it away from you. Your feet are spinning, but your hands need to draft the yarn, and the drafting of the yarn is what determines the size of your. There's a lot of things going on, and it's a lot to process. Even though I've taught you on the job, you know, it's still a lot to process. So I come up with little ways of explaining things, like with the drafting. I draft with my left hand and my right hand. That's the one that's closest to the wheel. So for me, I always tell people, your feet, they're building the spin. We're creating the energy for the twist. And so that twist, that energy is getting built up into the fiber. And with my right hand, with my two fingers, my thumb and my pointer finger, their job is they are the dam. That's the break. So that is stopping all of the twists that I'm building up with my feet. It's stopping it from my finger to the wheel. With my left hand, this is the hand that I use to determine what the size of my yarn is going to be. Is it going to be a figuring weight? Is it going to be a worsted? So I'm going to draft the fiber until it is the size that I want it to be. Once that happens, I have this. Is this how I explain it to them? You now have the break or the dam, which is the right yarn. And once you pull out the yarn that you want, I call it kissing because I like to feel the twist travel up the fiber to me. And so you release the energy, guide that energy from here until you kiss your other thing. Once they kiss, you now draft the dam with your left hand. So it's like, run away, run away, run away. And you're like, and then you let it go on to. So I'll find like funny little ways of having them visualize it, but at the same time understanding what they're doing. It's like their right hand is trapping the twist until you're ready to use it and share it with the rest of the fiber. Your left hand is preparing the fiber that you want to get twisted. Once you have that fiber prepared, now the right hand job is to bring all of that energy until it meets. Now, and once they're tipping, you let the wheel take it from you onto the bobbin, and then you do it again. Your left hand runs away, runs away, runs away, want to trap the yarn, and the right hand is just blocking all of that energy until the right. So I just come up with little anecdotes so that it becomes a thing in your head to understand what really the things they're doing. My favorite part of teaching somebody how to spin is when I get to witness their aha. All of a sudden, I just see them and they go, oh, well, and they see what happened. And then everything else falls into place. And that's my happy moment. That's when I'm like, yep, see that. And I let them take it home because that's the only way it's going to stick, is you have to be able to go home with it on your own terms. In a place where you're comfortable, where you don't have somebody watching over your shoulder, because it's my job to watch you, I'm your teacher, but it's also a little creepy because I'm watching you. So it takes time to work with something because it is a personal relationship. I will spin on it, I will in a different way. And I can give you my wheel if you're going to spin on my wheel in a different way. So you have to learn how that wheel reacts to you, and that wheel is going to learn how to react to you. It's a relationship. And once you figure out that relationship, it's all easy. It really is.
Tell us about, because I know you mentioned that you do contests. I've always heard about these contests, the fleece to shawl, and it's always just seemed like, oh my God, that just seems like a pressure cooker situation. But tell us about the contests that you've done.
It's wild. Again, I fell into it accidentally. Some of my friends needed an extra person on a team. It was at the Brooklyn Fair in Brooklyn, Connecticut. And I said, sure. And I had only spun at that point for like a year and a half. I didn't think I was a great spinner, but I knew that I was a fast spinner if I needed to be. And I can be very competitive. So, and I'm a good rallier. I'm a good, we can do this. I'm that person on the front line. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. We can totally do this. I had no idea what I was doing. So the way it was set up, I can't remember, it's something to scarf is the first one. I can't remember, it's not Ruby to scarf, but that's essentially what you're doing. And then the next day was a fleece to shawl. So essentially you have 4 hours and you are either working with prep roving or the next day just a full on fleece. And you have 4 members on the team. And it starts off usually where all 4 of us are spinning because you have to spin and fly enough yarn to actually get a project out. So usually the first hour we would have people spinning together. And I would most likely be the flyer because I flied very quickly. And then once I flied, I could also help knit. So we would spin together for the first hour. I would fly and then you would hand it off to your knitter or to your crochet. And they would just start. And that's the whole process. And you have 4 hours to complete a project. And for the shawl, you would have to card the roving, like literally take it off the fleece, card it, spin it, plot it, and then hand it off to your weave fitter, who would then weave on her pre-warped loom to a 72-inch completed shawl. And then there would be judges, and it's crazy, but it was just so much fun. And also, too, it was a great time to talk to people about what you were doing because it's not something that you see a lot of unless you're going to a place where a lot of this stuff is being done. So, a lot of people would come up that they wouldn't know what a spinning wheel was. So, they would ask the question. So, that was also part of our task. If we're competing, but we were also there to educate people and interest people. I loved it. There was one time there was a whole hurricane going on, and they kept looking at the weather to see when it was going to hit us fully. But we did it. We just spun all the way through. Climber artists are crazy, crazy people. We are nuts. The things that we do for our fiber is hysterical. But also, too, you would think that we were running a marathon because I remember my husband, he was on call. Because one of my wheels broke and I called him. I said, "Oh, go do it, somebody." He's like, "I'm on my way." And I showed up with my other wheel, stamped it down, took the other wheel, fixed it, put it on. It was crazy. One of my friends' grandsons always came and they would do rounds and they would bring us water and they would bring us food to keep us nourished. It's a lot. It's so fun, though. It's so fun. Is that it?
I don't spin, but I feel like I need to take a lesson with you. Well, two lessons.
We would have so much fun.
And I do have the family spinning wheel up in the attic. I think it dates from the 18th century.
It's probably not going to be the one she's going to use to.
No, no, no. But here's what needs to happen. Once you learn how to spin, you have to honor it by spinning just a little bit. So that is stress. That's the other part of my kookiness where I feel that all of the wheels that I have, and there are wheels that I have honestly just because I feel like they needed a home and they had a spring. But even those wheels, I spun something on that so that they had something that they created on its bobbin so that it validated their movement. I personalize it too much, and I know. But I just feel like they have to be honored for what they were meant to do, even if they are retired. You see what I mean? It's like, even though Your work days are over. I still feel like there's a little bit of pride within the wood of those wheels where they're proudly still holding on to something that they created. So all of my wheels, if they're not in rotation, they all have a little piece of yarn that they spun.
And actually, there's another family spinning wheel. Our maiden name is Klein, Kalein. And there's a Klein Museum in Mobridge, South Dakota. And our great grandmother's spinning wheel is in that museum. So we know that spinning came from both sides of the family, because the one that I have is from my mother's side. And the other one is from our dad's side.
See, you need to, it has to happen. And then you have to put a little bit of the wheel of the ones that are added, we're going to break it to the museum and we're going to spin a little bit on the one that it was thinking of. So she's holding on to a little something.
Feel like this is like a three-way Thelma and Louise movie starting to happen.
It is.
That we're going to go out to South Dakota and break into the museum, and then we're just going to sit there and spin. And then they'll come in the morning and they'll be like, whoa, what happened? This is like Rapunzel.
Or the night at the
You
museum.
just can't drive off the cliff. We'll just come home laughing.
No, we won't.
We don't need that part of
We'll just come
the
home. Tell us too about, because I did want to get to Woolworks, because both Booty and I just thought that was such a magical place, and we felt like we just sort of stumbled into it. Tell us the story of that and your role in it.
What's funny is the little shop in Chaplin, if she didn't grab something, Woolworths was the place that she would call to say, hey, do you have such and such? And they would kind of go back and forth to help each other out. But at that time, I was living in Plymouth, Connecticut, and Chaplin was much closer. And then years later, Jeff, my husband, had a new job, and it was in Massachusetts. It was in Framingham. And
Oh.
so I'm very close to my family, he's very close to his family. And so I started to get very anxious that it would be too far if we moved to Massachusetts right away, because we were so used to being 10 minutes apart as opposed to it would have been about an hour and 30 minutes. And so we decided that we would do like a year of a trial run to get everybody used to having a longer distance between us, but kind of halfway point, and that landed us in Putnam. So I lived a couple of streets up from Woolworth, and I wasn't working at the time, and I was bored out of my mind, and everyone had one car. So I said, well, I'm just gonna go for a walk, and I'm just going to see this new town that I live in. And I said, oh, the yarn shop is over there. I went into the yarn shop, and as it usually happens this way with me, is I will sit at a table or I will sit in a chair and I will start chatting it up with somebody. The next thing you know, we're the best of friends, and I have your phone number and all weird things happen. And just one day, I ended up helping a group of ladies at the table. They were stuck on a project, and I knew how to fix it, so I leaned over, and that ended up becoming a normal thing where I would just have something. Oh, and the next thing I knew, I had a seat because the owner at the time had an obligation, and so she said, do you mind? I said, nope. So she gave me the seat, and I never gave it back to her. That's kind of how it happened. And because I like to teach people things, I would start teaching little lessons in classes and stuff, and then I just became a part of the fiber of that place, like everybody does who walks into there. If you go in there, and we just naturally become a part of the fiber and the essence of that store. And then it just all eventually ended up rolling down to me. It went through another owner, and now the owner is with her family. She's got these adorable grandkids and things that she's taking care of and stuff. And so I stepped in so that I could manage for her so that she could spend time with her family. And that's what I've been doing for the last couple of years. And that shop is 100% volunteer. There's not a person who gets paid. That's a little bit. We go in there with just love and try to come up with all of the ideas to keep that place going and thriving, because it's just a very important hub for our community. We have people just who come from all walks of life, all different ages, people who probably wouldn't have anything to say to each other in any other capacity of their lives. And yet somehow they walk through those doors. There's like this common denominator. And the next thing you know, we're all friends. And we laugh together, we cry together. We really have become this very interesting family. I'm not gonna lie to you, the days around it's like, holy mother pearl, I'm exhausted. And if I didn't have people who love that shop as much as I did, I don't even know if I could continue to do something like this because that's a lot. But thankfully, there are just people who love that little place. We love that little place. And it would break our hearts if it wasn't there. It would break my heart if I knew I'd have to step away from it, especially if I felt like I had to step away from it and there wasn't somebody else to take the torch from me and keep it going, because that's how important it is to me. So I think we're doing well in terms of people love us. And I think that's what's going to keep us going, is that when people walk in there, they feel safe, they feel loved, there's no protection. I can't be more transparent than I am. I feel like I should come with a disclaimer. I cannot promise you that three-fourths of the things that come out of my face are appropriate. You know, I will apologize if it's inappropriate, but I am somebody who is motivated by just how I feel. And you get that from me right away. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that I'm okay. But I am going to tell you I'm not okay, but I'm going to be okay. Or I'm not okay, but I'm really happy to see you, and that's going to help me be okay. I'm going to be 50 in January, and I think one of the best things about getting older is that I realize I don't have the space or the energy anymore to try to present myself as something that I'm not. And if I can hurt you, all of the things that I am, I still think that you can love for all of those things. And I trust that more than trying to hand you something that's not real, because I know I don't have the energy to that up. So I'm not even going to bother. When you come in and you hear all of us singing the Brady Bunch, that, I mean, to me, that's a normal, that is a normal day.
And I think you captured it so well. Just we walked in, and it was just clear that everybody was enjoying being there and being together and working on projects, but mainly it was just being together and enjoying each other's company. And there were so many great stories. I don't know that we can share any of them. What happens at Woolworths stays at Woolworths.
We wish for those things. We wish.
Exactly.
I also appreciated that not only did you have some beautiful yarn and from some local shepherd, some farms, but you also had some handcrafted items that you could buy. So even if you're not a crafter, although I personally, if you have a crafter in your life, would love some hand-spun yarn by Tasha. All of your skeins are gorgeous.
Oh,
They're
thank you.
gorgeous.
There are these really cool multicolored, but we want to give you an opportunity to, if somebody wanted to buy some of your yarn or other things, how would they do that?
So funny, I spent just a bit of all of the things that you saw in those baskets. That's because Mandy has put them out to go home. I just spent, I never think about what I'm going to do with it. I never think about selling my thing ever. Like for me, I have never thought, and I'm going to sell this. I just don't. And Mandy said, these are so beautiful. Some people definitely want them. And I have that imposter syndrome. And I'm like, I want that. It's because everybody's going to want that.
Mandy is correct.
Yeah.
Let the record reflect that Mandy is correct.
Oh, maybe correct. See, how many times I have to look at her color that she's correct and I hate it so much. I'm like, oh, fine, you're right. You're right. I hate it so much because she has this adorable, cute little smug face that she gives me. And I just want to pinch her. So she did. She put them on the basket. I could post pictures of them. That's probably what's going to end up happening. And just call the shop and say, hey, gosh, I saw this, blah, blah, blah. Can I buy it? And it's 100% yet. I'm not attached to any of them. I just love the process of spinning them. I never think about what am I going to make with the yarn. I just want to spin it. I want to see what it becomes. I have these made from roving that I would never normally spend. I usually use it just for my needle coat.
Okay.
So it's not luxurious, it's nothing super special, it's just roving. And I didn't have anything I was in the mood to spend. So I was like, well, let's just take a pump of all of these colors, throw them in a basket, and then I'm just gonna spend them randomly. So I did, I spun them up randomly, like, well, that's gonna be interesting. Then I applied that, I was like, well, that's even more interesting. And I wasn't sure if it was a good interesting or a bad interesting. It was just interesting. And then I made these little fingerless mittens out of them, and they're probably my most favorite pair of fingerless mittens I've ever made in my whole life. It's
Oh.
my whole life using wool that I would have never thought about spinning. So for me, that's the other thing I tell people. You can make something beautiful out of anything. If you can spin it, it will be something beautiful. I surprise myself all the time. So a perfect example, because we have a spinning group that meets the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And so we'll get together and we'll spin for a few hours. And there's this, it's called Shave Up to Save Up. And so it's this initiative that spinners have started so that we can help a farm in the United States who are raising sheep that are on the verge of extinction.
Yeah.
And so they are shearing their sheep and we purchase from them. And then we get like little passport stamps. So it's kind of like the whole kind of thing. And we have this one, and then we put our little stamp in our little book. And it gives us the opportunity to work with fibers that we wouldn't normally be able to work with because they're either extinct or the animal is not usually used for its fiber. Usually it's like used for meat. They don't consider them to have a fiber that you would necessarily want to use for any sort of project. And so it's our way of helping our farmers thrive. It's our way of saving these breeds of sheep. And then we learned a bunch of different things using these fibers. So there was this one particular fiber, and I can't remember the name of it now, but let me tell you, I tend to spin very thinly. And that's the other thing with spinning. Once you get your groove and your little fingers figure out how they like to spin, it is very hard to go back to spinning like a thick, chunky, weird. So the yarn that we spin first and we hate it, we will never again be able to spin that kind of yarn, even if we want it to be like this art, lumpy, bumpy, thick and thick. You'll never do it again, ever, ever. But I spin although cobweb weight. So I almost have to buy my things three or four times to get like a K weight. Which is annoying because I had to spin for a very long time to end up with any quantity of anything to make something bigger. So I'm trying to get better at that, of being able to figure out where my casting spot is to get a thicker, but please be able to spin a worsted after just applying it once as opposed to having to spin three or four different bobbins to get a work suit. So there was a fiber that came in, and let me tell you, no matter what, it just wanted to be poofy and bumpy. And my fingers were fighting it, just fighting it. I wanted it to be what I wanted it to be, and this fiber was telling me, ma'am, this is not what I was meant to be. And so finally, I said, Miss Pasha, you need to listen to this fiber. And the only reason to listen to the fiber was I had to spin as fast as I could. I had to treadle as fast as I could so that I had no control over the wheel. And I had to eye, and I just had to just let the switch go and let it go. Just let it go and let it go. So I ended up with this great, lumpy, bumpy, kind of poofy at some spots, a little under some spots, thin yarn. That's the other important thing. If you're going to pick up spinning, you have to realize there are moments where your will not be done. If you want to enjoy the process sometimes, you just have to listen to the fiber and let the fiber tell you what it wants to be, because your journey will be far more enjoyable if you jump with it. So I did have enough, but in order for me to do that, because my fingers are so, they know what they want to do, but it was such a fight, I had to paddle as fast as I could. I mean, I was feeling like that spinning wheel like a lunatic. And then I had to close my eyes and just let the wheel take the fiber. And like I said, it was ugly on the bobbin because it's not what I'm used to spinning. I'm used to creating a fairly uniform yarn. It's not perfect, but it's fairly uniform. This is not uniform. I mean, she was chunky at some places. She was white, but I took it off the bobbin. I loved it. I watched it. And it's just, when I tell you, I don't think I've ever smelled a squishier yarn in my whole life. It's just squishy and lovely. And I don't know what she's going to be, but I can't wait for her to be something. I'm not sure I'm the one that's going to make her something else because I'm just happy to her. And I'm just so proud of myself that she made herself. She basically told me what she was going to be. So that makes me very happy. But there's a very good chance that her next journey is with somebody else. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody else took it, but I know exactly what she needs to be. And I would be very happy to move her along the next chapter of her journey. Because I feel honestly that I learned what I needed to from that fiber, where it was, you can't control everything. You are not meant to control everything. You do not get the final say of what is a good ending. You are not the final decision maker on what's considered to be beautiful or perfect setup. Just let it do what it wants to do. You're getting away with great things because it's just us.
Can you take a picture of that? Because I have to see this yarn now.
I will let me go to the shop. Yeah. Wait till you see it. It's just lumpy, puffy, green, beautiful green. She's a beautiful green. But let me tell you, it was not what I would have ever thought with my loss of my own wheel for sure.
I would love to see a picture of your wheels. I think everybody is probably wondering, how do you store 28
Well,
wheels?
I get thinking about it. So here's what I do. I have a lot of rum in my house. So there is a wheel pretty much in any room that I know that I'll be sitting in for any amount of time. And they each have their own little basket. So they're very working on their own little project. But then when that became too cumbersome, some of my bills are at the shop because I spent just as much time there. And then I have people, like if I go over their houses, so my wheel is over at their house if I spend a lot of time there. I feel that I am strategic about how I put my addiction out into the world. So you're not walking in and being like, bam, oh my gosh, you have all these wheels. They just all have the different places. So I have to get them all together where somebody looks at me and says, Natasha, this is a lot. But I love them. I have them.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I mean, I think we all have project bags. I have multiple project bags, also multiple Notion bags. So I have everything I need in each project
Yes,
bag.
it's important. And you know what? At the end of the day, it just brings me joy. It makes me happy. I think that they're useful. The functionality of it, you'll never be able to deny that they have a purpose. But I also feel that every wheel has a story. And if the wheel is brand new, it's waiting for a story to unfold. If you can find the time to sit with it, you are helping this thing become part of something bigger. And to me, that's always like really, really important. And I think aesthetically, they're just beautiful. And they each have their own language. Like I said, my little chatty Cathy, I chuckle every time I use that thing. And she's just like, quack, 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 quack. And she's not the prettiest thing, but I feel like she has a lot to say. And those are the sorts of things that also get passed up. Like the sister was saying, she have these wheels on both sides of the people who created you. They have a story. And I feel that they're waiting for another portion of their story. I think it's just a beautiful thing to say. I'm sitting on a wheel that my grandmother spun on, or to think about how many garments were made from yarn that was produced on this wheel. There's something powerful about something like that. There's a longevity to think like.
I love that. Just to switch gears for a second, we always ask, what is a recipe? And then we'll make it. What is one of your favorite or go-to recipes or recipe that you think we should make? Whatever that you can share with us.
So every year for New Year, a ship all over the world, we make what we call a soup, which is a basically like a squash or pumpkin soup.
Oh.
And every Haitian family, I say every, but it might be an exaggeration, but it's our Haitian tradition and how we start our new year. So January 1st, just know that most Haitians in the world are making soup. It's important to us because of how Haitians celebrate their independence, because when they were basically enslaved, they were allowed to cook the squash, but they weren't allowed to eat it. And when Haiti emancipated itself and freed itself, that became their food of independence. And so every year on January 1st, we make this huge pot of soup and shovel. And it's just a delicious squash soup with vegetables, your potatoes, your carrots, your whatever meat you want. We usually put beef in ours. And it's cooked all day. And when we were growing up, my mother followed the tradition that her family had started with her, where you would share it with your neighbor all day. All families were making this big pot of soup, and her mother would put soup in bowls, and the kids would go out and they would share soup with all the others. And it was just their way of celebrating each other and sharing with their people and just sharing love and prosperity for the year and hopefulness and all of those things. And so for me, that's just always been just one of my favorite things to eat, because it's warm and it's filling and aromatic and it tastes good. But again, just the story behind it, and then just knowing that my mother was raised that way and she shared it, and then with us, we shared it, and we would share it with our neighbors, which is always really nice because we didn't grow up around a lot of Haitian people here. We had a lot of Haitian families that we would visit quite often, so our culture was always very important to us, but it wasn't like I could just step out in my yard and be like, oh, fellow Haitian, you know? What I love to talk about it is that my mom would share the soup with other people, and then it allowed us to share something about ourselves, but it was also nice to see that other people were interested in sharing in those things as well, too. So I remember the first year that we had done it with one of our newest neighbors when I was a kid. I think it was probably like 11 or 12. And we had done it for 1 year where we brought her soup. And she was just so excited about it. And then the next year, when we went over to her house to bring her the bowl of soup, she had that she had made for us. So we exchanged bowls of soup. And it was just the first time that had ever happened with somebody who wasn't patient, but she was so touched the year before with my sharing our culture with her. It moved her enough to wake up on, so she was ready. So New Year's Day, she had all of her ingredients ready and she made soup. And so when we went with our soup, she was also able to share her soup with us. For New Year's Day, if you want, just make yourself a small little pot of soup and see how you feel about it. It's really tasty. It's just such a great way to connect with other people.
Oh, I love that story. Thank you so much for sharing so many things. I feel like we learned so much about spinning, but I love the threads that came through it of about community and about sharing stories and about the personalities that emerge not only from the wool and the fibers, but also from the spinning wheels. And it was just such a delight. And I feel like the soup story is sort of the culmination of all of those things. So I can't wait to make it.
You're going to love it. You make it. You'll find it every year you're going to do something a little different, and you're going to end up making it your own. And that's what my mom told us. She said, I mean, this is a funny little story. She's old enough now where it's not going to matter. No one's going to get in trouble. But she did say that they would come home with all of these different soups from all of these different families. And she said, but you know, some people just don't know how to cook. And so the kid would come home with the soup. But they say, oh, that one comes from Mrs. Someone, so I don't want that one. And oh, I don't like that one, blah, 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 blah. But what my grandmother used to do is she would have two big pots on the stove, and she'd have the one pot of the soup that she had made it for herself. And then the other pot was the pot where she would take everybody's soup from the neighborhood and she poured it in that pot. The pot became everyone else's soup, and then she would feed them it. And they could taste, uniform, and everybody would too. But she refused to let people say, "I'm not eating that soup because so and so made that soup." She says, "No, so and so made that soup, so and so put time and love into that soup to share with us. We are eating that soup." And so she would pour everything on her in one big pot, so she didn't know whose soup was what, and she would eat everything up together in the end, and at the end of the day, eat everybody's soup without any sort of discrimination.
It's a true melting pot.
It's a coffee pot. And what's so funny about my grandmother, she was like 5'2". She was a tiny, feisty little thing, but you didn't mess with her. She was like, "Nope, we're eating the soup." You can eat the
I love
Thank
it.
you so much for joining us. This has just been such a delight and pleasure, and I
Oh.
so appreciate you spending the time and sharing so many things with us. And I can't wait to try the soup. Booty, do you have anything else you want to add? Just thank you. This was a delight. I loved every
I had
minute.
so much fun.
And I'm definitely going to have to sign up for some spinning. I think that might have to be my winter project. He needs another
You're
project.
gonna love it. But you know what? I do want to try it. So, my friend Alex and I, we cook a lot together. Like when I go over to his house, we cook. We are going to try your mom's damn brownies.
Janet's damn brownies.
I
are so good. They're just a thing.
can't be. I'm fascinated by the frosting. So, I'm fascinated. I was like, wait a minute. They put it on the brownie when it's hot. Like, so I was just like, I need to make the brownie. But thank you both so much for inviting me to do this.
Well, and I think it's time to say, whatever you do, don't
Don't
knit
knit
like
like
my
my
sister.
sister. Do spin like Tasha, and you can find Woolworks in Putnam, Connecticut. You don't have a website.
Not yet. We're working on a website. So we already go through Facebook right now, but we are going to work. If I had to give you my smoke signal, it would probably be better. But we're working on it.